IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. Conversations around regulation of technology companies, especially those afflicted with the curse of bigness, typically come from three perspectives, from data privacy, intermediary liability, and the competition and antitrust angle. Today, I have with me Anupam and Rohan to discuss the developments around the third of these. Now, over the last few years, there's been a lot of renewed focus on the underlying principles of competition and antitrust. And with the Biden administration appointing Tim Wu to the National Economic Council and nominating Lina Khan to the FTC. And if you couple that with the antitrust subcommittee report from late 2020, you would expect that we're going to see a lot more activity on this front over the next couple of years, right? And if you enjoy these sort of conversations, do remember that the Takshila Institution offers a 12-week graduate certificate program in technology and policy, as well as others in public policy, defense, foreign affairs, and health and life sciences. For more information, you can go to takshila.org.in/courses. Now, Rohan, I want to come to you first, right? There's been a lot of activity on the antitrust front, and we expect to see a lot more, right? So can you talk us through some of the most recent proposals?
Okay, so what's been happening in a broad context, and let me lay this out. Biden has nominated Lina Khan to the FTC. Lina Khan, of course, her claim to fame began as a very interesting paper she wrote for the Yale Law Review called Amazon's Antitrust Paradox. I think we'll try to link that in the show notes. But since then, she has served in the congressional committee that came about in the late 2020, as Prateek mentioned before. And Tim Wu, of course, is a Columbia University law professor whose contribution actually is to start this whole applying antitrust to tech firms debate and sort of deviate from the Chicago School of Antitrust. And it is quite significant, his appointment to the National Economic Council, because he is now going to be advising President Biden on competition policy and tech firms in general. So I think the common thread that runs between them is that they're both critics of big tech companies. Lina Khan more so of Amazon than of the others, of course. And in this context, we see that Senator Amy Klobuchar, who's of course a renowned tech critic herself, has proposed a new legislation called Kalera.
Yeah. So what we want to, I think, focus on is that this shift in the kind of philosophy towards big companies, tech companies, and of course, big tech companies, right? And so if you look at this kind of historical evolution of antitrust law, and we won't get too deep into that, but from Robert Boggs, 1971 onwards, where we're talking about, the original antitrust paradox, we changed from this sort of going after monopolies for the sake of them being too big to, defining a new standard for antitrust law, which is purely based on consumer harm, right? So, or consumer welfare, rather. And so, we've had this consumer welfare standard for a good period of, let's say, 45, 50 years, maybe. And now, you're seeing that shift in that philosophy again of how do you look at antitrust law. All of these are interesting kind of developments in that. So you look at even the Trump administration, they went after big tech in some ways, but the election was in many ways, a watershed moment, right? In the sense that you have both sides of the aisle saying that we should go after big tech on different issues, of course, but both of them saying that we should go after the big tech companies, right? And each of the Democrat candidates, for instance, had their own set of policies as to how do you go after big tech, right? And they were almost trying to outdo each other in terms of who can be more stringent from, of course, the now hopefully historic kind of proposition on breaking up big tech to many other variants of the same, right? So now that we've got a Democrat in power in Biden, we've seen all of these changes that Rohan mentioned. These are really interesting things. So it is in that context that we should see this latest set of rules, right? The latest set of, at least, not, I mean, they've not become rules yet, but proposal for a law, Klobuchar's Kalera. And Rohan, what does Kalera stand for?
Hey, that is a good question, and that is an acronym I have not gotten to the bottom of yet. Maybe Prateek can help us out here.
Yeah. So CLERA is basically the Competition and Antitrust Law Enforcement Reform Act. That's what CLERA is, and it follows on from the Antitrust Subcommittee report, which essentially made recommendations around three lines, three broad areas, which was to promote fair competition, to strengthen laws relating to mergers and monopolization, and restoring oversight and enforcement of these antitrust laws. That was what the subcommittee report said, and CLERA seems to follow on from that.
Yeah, but though I think in the CLERA version, the emphasis is a lot more on the mergers and acquisitions. Though, I mean, not so much, for instance, on vertical integration, etc., which the subcommittee report went in quite some detail to, right? So here, by and large, the big focus is on mergers and acquisitions. And so you've had a drastic kind of shift in what these proposals say, right? In terms of how do they want to approach mergers and acquisitions, especially by the big tech companies. Now, I'll just start before we go into the exact propositions, that CLERA proposes. We have to mention one thing though, right? That you cannot have a separate set of antitrust laws for big tech and separate set of laws for other sectors. So whatever CLERA proposes will eventually mean that it is applicable across the board, right? So it will mean that it's applicable to cement companies, to automotive, car companies, to airlines, and so on and so forth. It applies to every other sector. So you can't have sector-specific antitrust laws, right? And this is important in many ways. We'll come to that. So, Rohan, again, back to you. Can you give the main kind of principles? And we'll take that one by one, and we'll see if we can make sense of that.
Sure. So there's basically three points that the proposed legislation wants to talk about. And I think let's begin with the burden of proof for mergers, right? Because I think that's a very... I have a lot of thoughts on this. So the basic idea is that the legislation wants to shift the burden of proof to the business community that acquisitions do not harm competition. Of course, this is something that was mentioned in the big Senate hearing that happened in late 2020. And the basic idea is that this was modified Section 7 of the Clayton Act. And it's the act that deals with mergers and acquisition to basically forbid mergers that create an appreciable risk of materially lessening competition, rather than the current language that only prohibits mergers and acquisitions that risk substantially lessening competition. Let me sort of break that down for you. Basically, the courts misinterpret, and I'm saying misinterpret in air quotes, that the current Clayton Act language demands a near certainty of future harm before allowing a deal. This would change that. If your merger risks creating monopsony power, this is going to make hard for you to be able to do that. Yep, so the burden of proof is sort of not an outright ban on mergers and acquisitions, but a requirement that companies demonstrate that the benefits of a transaction to consumers and competition significantly outweigh any risks. So it's more of a, I think it's more of a problem for, I think, smaller companies that want to get acquired by Facebook. So for example, and I think people don't talk about this enough, the GP acquisition that Facebook made, I wonder how this legislation would have interpreted that. But that's the basic idea here.
Yeah. That's,
so, while we're on the Jiffy acquisition, I think the UK Competition Authority is actually taking a look at that. But yeah, just to come back.
Right. So, there's a lot to unpack here, right? One is the fact that they've shifted the burden from the regulators to the merging companies themselves. So, traditionally, what would happen is that the regulators will have to first, and so there's more things that I'm going to add here, but the regulators will first have to prove dominance. And in order to prove dominance, you have to define the relevant market and then prove that they're dominant. And then you have to prove that an acquisition will lead to further dominance, and that dominance will lead to harm, right? So this is the normal kind of procedure. Now you've shifted that to say that every merger above a certain monetary threshold, and I'll come to that threshold, every merger above a certain threshold is automatically considered to be harmful unless proven otherwise. So this is a kind of a twist where, innocent until proven guilty is now kind of twisted on its head to say it's guilty unless proven innocent, right? So now the merging companies, the burden is on the merging companies to prove that the acquisition or the merger will not lead to the harm. Right, so that is one massive change. Now, that is a change in approach. But how do you think it'll play out in reality? The way I see it is, again, the big companies have an army of lawyers, right? And by the way, the reason why they say they've done this is to reduce the kind of burden on the regulators, that the regulators do not have enough financial resources in order to prove all of this, right? So, which is why they've said we'll do it the other way around. Now, if you look at it from a common sense or a legal, both common sense and a legal perspective, it doesn't make sense. You cannot say because the police don't have enough resources, we're going to assume that everyone is a thief unless they prove otherwise, right? That is exactly what this translates to, which on every sense, on every other level doesn't make sense. So just keep that in mind. That's what the new kind of law is saying. Now, two, and therefore, because the regulators don't have enough resources, it's up to the merging companies to prove that they will not cause harm. Okay, so that's the big kind of this thing. Now, how do you think that'll work out? According to me, the big companies have enough resources to make sure that they can, throw paperwork after paperwork after paperwork to basically show that no acquisition or this thing is in fact harmful. I mean, of course, they will try and do that, which means ultimately the regulators will still have to go through all of that. You remember the subcommittee report when they were having the hearings and when they asked for evidence from Google. I think Google sent, 42,000 documents? Rohan, do you remember?
I think it's a lot more than that. And also, they didn't give a search pool to go with that. So, the irony is just...
Of course, right? So, I mean, that's what every company will do. They have an army of lawyers, which means that they will throw all of this at the regulators and prove that it's not going to be harmful. And that ultimately means that you will have all of this, right? You will have regulators who will have to go through all of that and then disprove what they've proved. So it's not going to really make things any less difficult for the regulators. But I think that approach itself is against the kind of common law sense, right? That you can't just assume everything is going to be harmful at the start. So that, for me, is where I take a massive objection to. The second bit, which I want to talk about, is that threshold, right? So they're saying that every deal or acquisition above $50 million monetary threshold is going to be assumed to be harmful. And so that, again, and especially by a dominant company, etc. Now, that is harmful because, ridiculous because of two reasons, right? One, we know that a lot of these deals in terms of monetary thresholds don't matter. I mean, we've talked about this. If you really want to be successful in preventing kind of dominance, you have to look at the data threshold, right? And the network effects in play, not really just the monetary threshold. So that's something I'm surprised that no one really talked about, or I don't think there are enough tools to look at that. And third, I think what I found really troublesome is the fact that they don't have to define the market. Right, the relevant market in which this kind of dominance plays out. So then you can imagine if you don't have that market definition in place, you are you can essentially, this is a classic kind of problem, right? Is the Uber and your bus service belonging to the same market or not? And so on and so forth. Is Amazon competing against your retailer? And the answers are wildly different. So you need to first define the market before you can go into all of this. I think deviating from that for ease of and for convenience will result in more harmful kind of outcomes than otherwise.
So let me just try to offer a different perspective on this, and as one that sort of supplements this. And I think I do a fair bit of reading, and a lot of the reading that I do is, of course, based on how tech companies started and how they, what their exit plan was. And more often than not, you will notice that companies actually begin in the hope that they will eventually get acquired by big firms like Facebook. And of course, I don't mean to say that all of big tech companies are big on acquisitions. I think Facebook, for example, is into acquisitions in a huge way, whereas Amazon or Apple are not so much, right? So my point is that in some way, this is anti-business. And of course, the other part of this is that if a company is too big, it acquires someone else, it becomes even bigger, and that's bad for innovation. But also, like, you have to acknowledge that the ecosystem as it exists today also sort of exists in a way, because these companies are actually viable exit strategies for budding startups. And without that, you might not have this, and the second order effect that no one actually anticipated, and it will go away, because right now I think it is a source of innovation. And so I feel like in that way, particularly, it seems anti-business to me. I know this argument sort of shoots itself in the foot, of course, but I think that this is a point that still needs to be made.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think that, but just to sort of put a different color, right? I think some of this is coming from the observation of how a lot of these companies have acted over post-acquisition, right? And I think the right way to handle that is to go after enforcement rather than this presumption of harm just based on either the company size or the deal size.
Yeah, so exactly. I didn't think I would be saying this today, but I absolutely agree with you, Rohan.
That was the take.
Yeah.
So that's why it makes sense.
the fact is that actually acquisitions are a major driver of innovation. Not just that, acquisitions are also a major source of, believe it or not, are a major reason for funding in the first place. Right? A small company gets funded by VCs on the hope that they were going to get acquired. So VCs actually go ahead and fund small companies when there's an exit plan involved. And that exit plan is being acquired by Google or Amazon or Facebook or whatever, right? So in that sense, if you don't have that exit plan and you're going to make acquisitions a lot tougher, then it will mean that, you know, small companies will find it a lot harder to get funding in the first place. And if they don't get funding, then, you know, the chance of that innovating product coming through is a lot lesser. So I agree with you on that one. And Pratik, absolutely on what you said as well. So if you have a case where, I think that presumption of harm is, as I think I made my position clear on that. So it's about what do you do after acquisition, right? And that is where I think one of the things that I appreciate about this move is that they've given a little bit more teeth to the FTC and DOJ. That is, they've increased the budget. I think they've given a $300 million whatever budgetary resources for them to go after some of these things. And I think that is absolutely required. You need better tools to be able to diagnose, to be able to, correctly, I think, yeah, diagnose the problem and then apply these antitrust, whatever laws that you have, much more efficiently. And as they have mentioned, they don't have the resources. So one way is to, start with that, get better resources, and then apply your antitrust laws. You can't presume harm. So you're absolutely right on that count.
And I think it goes a little further in saying that there's a provision to that federal agencies can move beyond just seeking injunctions and those sort of remedies, right? Where essentially saying, okay, you can do this or you can't do this, and to go beyond that.
Yeah.
Can I also just add, okay, so I want to break this down a little bit, because we have talked about the increased funding for the FTC and the DOJ, which is, I think it's important. The way it's playing out is that you give these agencies a bunch of money, and instead of having one huge case against Google or whoever, you atomize the strategy, see what sticks on the wall, and basically attack them on all fronts so that the firm's resources are also divided. There is that. But the way I also sort of understand this is that there is funds and then there is power. And I don't think the FTC, the incentive structure for them, I don't think is aligned enough to allow them to do more than just settle with firms. So if you remember, FTC has recently, they have settled with Facebook for $5 billion. And I think that's the largest fine that the FTC has ever put on a company, which is on its own a lot of money, but it's also pocket change for Facebook. So what I'm trying to say here is that more funds are great, but I also don't think this automatically means that this translates into more power per se.
Yeah.
So with that caveat, I think we can move on.
Yeah. You need more funds with, I think, a very clear mandate as to what's to be done. We know this from kind of bureaucracy 101. If you just give more funds with no mandate, then they'll go all over the place and do whatever. Right. So I think having a clear, and some part of it has to be, as I said, into not just going after companies, but to developing these frameworks using which you can, run your, at the end of all of this, we still don't have a good working definition of many of these things, right? So even, you know, how do you come to definitions of market, the relevant market, etc., and which is why we are using more ad hoc kind of definitions. So I think in a lot of, and even developing tools, doing studies on antitrust behavior, I think a lot of these things, which a lot of independent, by the way, researchers are doing in the US, I think a lot of this can be done by the FTC. Part of their FTC can be just a research team. And I've been actually arguing the same that should be done in India as well. I mean, CCI should have a very strong research team that can look at some of these behaviors. And then once you're only able to identify, can you try and solve it, right? I don't think we're doing a very good job in even identifying the problem. So that bit.
I think if the CCI just acquired the Ken, it would just be a huge step up because at least they'll know what's going on.
Pratik, if I may, I want to talk about one other thing, right? Which is very worrying for me in terms of the development. So this is again what Rohan mentioned, which is about the changing of the kind of threshold, right? From proving that there is harm to this new definition, or which is about the appreciable risk of materially lessening competition, right? So what you've essentially done is that, apart from that preemptive part that I've talked about, you've also given a lot of discretion. You've essentially given a lot of discretion to your regulators. And for me, increasing discretion in a politically polarized society and political system is kind of bound to lead to suboptimal outcomes, right? Think about any number of situations in which, where you're increasing the discretionary kind of aspect of regulation. So you could go after companies that you don't like. I mean, think about this. You have a Republican government in power and you have, let's say, Twitter muting the president. What do you think will happen to Twitter then? Right? And many such scenarios. I think, so you're highly politicizing this entire aspect by making it discretionary. I always prefer a rules-based approach for many of these things because you don't want the discretion in the hands of politically charged, especially in a politically charged atmosphere. That's potentially, yeah, I think that's potentially harmful, right?
Can we also sort of talk about Lina Khan's arguments here? Because I think there's a lot of value in talking about them. I think the interesting thing for me is that if you look at how things have been shaping up, the FTC has sort of had an incentive, not an incentive. They have, I think the mandate has been to look at Facebook, and the DOJ has looked at Google. Lina Khan, of course, has sort of started her antitrust career by looking at Amazon. And I don't think they have come under scrutiny as much. And I think we can talk about what it means to be a monopsony in the US. I think Anupam can help us with that. But generally, I think she has two excellent papers, which we can link in the show notes. But she says that there are three sources of market power, right? She says there's firstly gatekeeper power. A gatekeeper can use power to extract better terms from people who depend on platforms' infrastructure. So think about Amazon exploiting booksellers, app stores, for example. Then there's leveraging, right? Platforms use platforms serve as critical infrastructure and are integrated across markets. So they can use market dominance in one market to gain an advantageous position in a different market. And finally, you've got information exploitation, where platforms gather vast amounts of information and can use that to engage in first-degree price discrimination. Right? So I think Uber has admitted to doing that a lot. And I think Project Greyball is also something that we should look into. If you have time, dear listener, I think you should look into that. And this sort of brings me to Amazon in a way, because if you look at Amazon, and this is just off the top of my head, Amazon is a retailer. It is now a marketing platform. It's a delivery and logistics network, a payment service, a credit lender, an auction house, a major book publisher, a producer of televisions and films, a fashion designer, hardware manufacturer, a leading host of cloud server space. And this is all, I'm not even talking about Amazon Media Group. Okay, like this, I am not getting into that. And although Amazon has clocked staggering growth, it generates meager profits. And it sort of chooses to price below cost and expand widely. And sort of the consumer welfare standard that we have, it sort of underappreciates the model that Amazon has come up with. And I think it's a company that has leveraged public policy in a way to expand, which I think was truly in every sense of the word, unprecedented. So what in that standard needs to change going forward is something I've been struggling with.
Yeah, fantastic point, Rohan. And I'm also really impressed with the fact that you could name all of that on the top of your head. I think we can, you know, there's a game that in the US, right, or even in India, where people are asked to name all the 50 states in the US or 29 states in India. I think we can do that, name all of Amazon services, or that'll be an interesting
one. We would be here for a while.
Yeah. So, with Lina Khan, I think her problem definition is not wrong at all. I think she hits the spot when you talk about in terms of the problem identification definition and so on. That entire Amazon's antitrust paradox, the first 50-60% is about a very detailed kind of description of all the things that Amazon does, which is borderline, which is illegal, borderline illegal, and legal but should be illegal. Right. So, and I think that identification is correct. And there's a lot of even research studies which point to the same direction. Now, the only problem I have with Lina Khan's thing is the prescription that follows in terms of what's to be done. And I think she unfortunately goes the same way as the Democrats in terms of, you know, we should break up the big tech, we should disintegrate them, we should do, you know, go after them in terms of these massive fines and so on. And I have problems with that, with which I think many of our listeners would know. I've mentioned it many other times. In terms of what needs to change, I think the consumer harm standard or consumer welfare standard is still, it's still very relevant, but you can make and you should make a very simple change to that, which is that when you're talking about two-sided markets, you should look at both sides of the market as consumers. So for an Amazon, a seller on Amazon is also a consumer of Amazon. But this is a consumer of Amazon, the platform. A buyer on Amazon, we already see them as a consumer, so we apply the consumer welfare standard. But I think the mistake that many people do is that when Amazon hurts the businesses, we don't look at that particularly, or we don't, you know, follow that up as much because they're not considered as consumers, right? We only look at the other side. And when on the other side, there are discounts after discounts, there's no appreciable change in price. In fact, variety is increasing, etc. You don't really look at that as consumer harm. But the actual consumer harm is taking place on the other side of the market, which are also consumers, by the way. So a seller on Amazon is a consumer of Amazon, and there is harm being done there. And if you apply that kind of consumer welfare standard, you could kind of solve that to some extent. So when you have, let's say, data protection of consumers, you should look at data protection of the sellers on Amazon, because they're also consumers, right? And then all of these nasty things that Amazon does, I think, will get covered under that, right? Because Amazon steals data from the third-party vendors on the platform and then uses that to come up with its own products. We know that. And yes, this is what even Lina Khan expertly kind of points out. So we know that. So now you can stop that with this kind of, extending that data privacy and protection to the other side of the market as well. So I think that is the change that is required in competition law. I'm overly simplifying it, of course, here, but the principle is exactly that.
No, and what you just said, right, is actually something even the antitrust subcommittee report points out in a little obscure section called additional measures. Right, but it does talk about this fact of treating both sides as customers, and it goes further and says that we should potentially decouple, and you know, it's enough to prove harm on just one side rather than both sides, right? And even Dina Srinivasan, I think, in her papers about Google and Facebook, it takes this information exploitation angle, right? Or in Google's case, it was the information exploitation angle that you just said in Amazon's context. And in Facebook's case, you talk about, okay, it's a zero price market, but how do you, you know, maybe you equate consumer harm to quality of service or to privacy, right? And so essentially expanding the definition of consumer harm to look beyond just prices.
Yeah. So I think in a lot of cases, right, there could be some dramatic kind of changes required, but in a lot of cases, you just need incremental changes to the current definitions to be more relevant to the information age economies, right? So when you're talking about, two-sided platforms, you just have to look at both sides of the platform. So in many cases, you don't need the drastic breaking up. A simpler kind of measures will do, which will then, ensure that consumers are still benefiting massively from these companies. But at the same time, you're also, stopping and helping the kind of consumer harm for the businesses.
Change happened at the margin, right? As we like to say.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So this was a great conversation. I think there's going to be a lot more developments on this front in the months that follow, because the chairman of the antitrust subcommittee also said they're planning a series of bills. So I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to talk about this again. On that note, thanks for joining me, guys.
Thank you.
The Takshashila Institution is an independent, non-partisan think tank and a school of public policy. We have education programs lasting one semester and 1 year that are tailored specifically for people like you. They are all online and you can take them from anywhere. Admissions are now open for our 12-week graduate certificate program in public policy, defense and foreign affairs, technology policy, and health and life sciences. Visit takshashila.org.in/courses to find out more. If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.